For the rest of this hour, a look at the intersection of economics and the environment and what it means for our planet. But first, I'm going to give you a little quiz. See if you can guess which country I'm talking about. It consumes more of the world's grain, steel, and meat than any other country. They mine and burn a quarter of the world's coal. 6,000 mine workers were killed in their mines in 2004. Their military budget is third behind the U.S. and Russia, and they have plans to put a probe on the moon in 2007. According to one estimate, about 81%, 8 out of 10 toys sold here in the U.S. are made there. And about 80% of all Christmas tree ornaments and decorations sold around the world are made there. Well, you probably have it by now. I'm talking, of course, about China. And according to my next guest, China's extraordinary economic growth is going to stretch our already stressed natural systems past the breaking point. He says that at current growth rates, by 2031, that's about 25 years from now, China will have an appetite for oil larger than what the whole world currently produces. So what does that mean for the rest of us? My next guest believes that China is just the tip of the iceberg of a global economy that is outgrowing the capacity of our Earth to support it, leading to a possible collapse of our modern way of life. Lester Brown is the founder and president of the Earth Policy Institute. His latest book is Plan B 2.0, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. He joins us from our studios in Washington. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Doesn't sound very optimistic once again as you weren't last time you were here.
Actually, there are a lot of things we can do to put the world economy on a sustainable path. But it's not going to be easy. It's going to take a lot of restructuring. But we have the technologies needed to do it. I mean, as you well know, for decades now, ecologists have been saying that we need to restructure the world economy in order to protect the natural support systems, to stabilize climate, to deal with the sorts of problems that Professor Blaustein was describing a few minutes ago. But unfortunately, there haven't been enough people convinced of the need to do this. Now, what's happening in China is beginning to convince economists that we're going to have to make some changes big time. I mean, perhaps the most important contribution of Plan B 2.0, at least according to the early readers, is the simple calculations on China. First of all, China now consumes more of the basic resources than the U.S. does. I mean, ever since you and I can remember, we've been saying that the U.S., 5% of the world's people, consumes a third or maybe even 40% of the world's resources. And that was true for a long time, but it no longer is. China now consumes more grain, more meat, more coal, more steel. Among the major commodities, the only one the U.S. still leads in is oil. But the fact that China has now overtaken us in total consumption of these basic commodities gives us license to ask the next question, which is, what if they catch up to us in consumption per person? And if the Chinese economy continues to grow at 8% a year, a bit slower than in recent years, then by 2031, income per person in China will be the same as in the U.S. today. And then, if we assume similar consumption patterns, then we have a real eye-opener. We have a country that will have 1.45 billion people that will be consuming the equivalent of two-thirds of the current world grain harvest. Their paper consumption at U.S. per capita levels would be double current world production. There go the world's forests. Or we look at automobiles, for example. If China one day has three cars for every four people, as the U.S. does, they will have a fleet of 1.1 billion cars. The world currently has 800 million cars. They would have to pave for roads, highways, parking lots, an area comparable to the area they now plant in rice. Beyond that, they would consume 99 million barrels of oil a day. The world currently produces 84 million barrels a day and will probably never produce much more than that. What China is teaching us is that the Western economic model, the fossil fuel-based, automobile-centered, throwaway economy, is not going to work for China. If it doesn't...
Did they realize this?
they're beginning to sense it. And I base that partly on discussions with senior officials in China. But it won't work for China, nor will it work for India, which by 2031 will have a population even larger than that of China. And it won't work for the other 3 billion people in the developing countries who are also dreaming the American dream. And perhaps most importantly, in a global economy, in an integrated global economy where we all depend on the same grain, oil, iron ore, forest products, etc., it won't work for us either. And that's the message of the book, the need to restructure the global economy so that economic progress can continue.
And how do you, as an architect of this restructuring, how do you see it being restructured?
Well, instead of being fossil fuel-based, it would be powered by renewable sources of energy. Instead of being automobile-centered, transport systems would be much more diverse. Instead of a throwaway economy, we would have a comprehensive reuse-recycle economy. We see glimpses of this new economy now emerging in various parts of the world. We see it in the wind farms of Western Europe, the solar rooftops of Japan, the reforested mountains of Korea, the growing fleet of gas-electric hybrid automobiles in the United States, the bicycle-friendly streets of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. So it's beginning to emerge, and perhaps the most exciting single development now is what's happening with wind energy. In Europe, wind farms now supply the electricity needs, the residential electricity needs of 40 million Europeans. By 2020, that's projected to hit 195 million, which will be half of Europe's population. Europe is quite literally leading the world into the age of wind now. In this country, we have an enormous supply of wind energy, which is being harnessed, but not fast enough. Worldwide, it's growing about 30% a year. This past year in the U.S., it grew by about 35%. But it's going to grow even faster probably this year, particularly with some of the major new companies, large corporations in the business like GE, which came in 2 years ago. Goldman Sachs has now bought a wind company. It's a subsidiary of Goldman Sachs, and they have some 5,000 megawatts of wind energy either under construction or in the planning stage. I mean, that's equivalent to, say, 17 typical coal-fired power plants around the country. So things are beginning to move, but still not fast enough.
Yeah. I just was reading about the Whole Foods company making a major investment in wind power. All of their stores will be using wind-generated electricity.
Interesting. It's also interesting that a lot of utilities and a lot of the utilities have been offering their consumers electricity from renewable sources, most importantly from wind energy, but charging a premium of 5, 10, or 15% above the price for their other sources of electricity. But that's now beginning to change because with natural gas prices going up so fast, the price of electricity generated from natural gas is now moving above the cost of wind power. And so some companies are now trying to lock in long-term contracts for wind energy because they know it's going to be one of the cheapest sources of electricity available in the future.
How will wind energy, for example, satisfy China's desire to populate the country with automobiles or at least even power them if they desire to do that?
Let me use the U.S. to illustrate that point because the U.S. and China both have enormous amounts of wind energy. The exciting thing is that we have advances in technology in the design of gas electric hybrids and in wind turbines that set the technological foundation for an entirely new automotive energy economy. If in this country, either for reasons of climate stabilization or oil insecurity, we decided that over the next decade, we would shift entirely to gas-electric hybrids with an efficiency approaching that of today's Toyota Prius, we could cut our gasoline use in half.
But isn't that going to take a policy decision, a Jimmy Carter-like, you know, presidential effort, or in China, the, you know, political decision in China or in India or these other countries to go ahead and do those things to spur them on?
It probably will take some leadership, but the market is already beginning to drive some of these processes. Once we get gas electric hybrids, then we have another option, which is to add a second storage battery and a plug-in capacity. Then you can plug your car in at night while you're sleeping, and we can do our short-distance driving, the daily commute, grocery shopping, et cetera. We can do that all with electricity.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking with Lester Brown, author of Plan B, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. Plan B 2.0, actually. It's sober reading, and if you know Lester Brown's work, like we've been talking about it over the years, you know it's a really interesting reading. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Hugh in Oakland. Hi, Hugh.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, go ahead.
I'm calling. Traditionally, in international agreements, U.S. and other world leaders, even progressive European leaders, have not wanted to include the environment as part of international accords. What has often happened as an indirect result of this is that industries which have moved to China and might have been regulated here, for example, textiles and pollution coming out of textile mills, as well as chemical companies, get moved over to China where we now buy our products from, and there's less or no regulation. And I wanted to find out whether it's, you know, what the author thinks about whether the environment should not be now included in some of these international accords.
Well, the environment is included in some, but not nearly enough. I mean, the Kyoto Protocol was an interesting example of an agreement that's focused entirely on climate change, which is probably far and away the number one environmental issue that we're facing.
I guess specifically what I'm talking about is international trade accords, which affect commerce, not only environmental accords.
Yes, good point. There's no question but that some companies have been moving to China, not only because of cheap labor, but because of either the lack of environmental requirements or lax enforcement of those requirements. And what that's now translating into is an environmental nightmare for the Chinese in terms of both air pollution and water pollution. And we're probably going to see a lot more examples of leaks of the sort that developed on the Songhua River in the north of China back around Thanksgiving time, when a large amount of benzene was discharged into the river that affected not only the Chinese downstream, but eventually the Russians as well, as the river made its way toward the sea.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Hugh. We're talking with Lester Brown, author of Plan B 2.0, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. There was news this week, I think it was yesterday, that California announced a new initiative for solar power in the state, with the goal being to make California a world leader in solar power. We see lots of other states themselves taking initiatives to try to work on their own where they feel the federal government is falling behind. New York sometimes follows with environmental laws, or trying to follow California with car regulations for miles per gallon or tailpipe emissions. Why is it that California is always in the front of these things?
I don't know. I've often thought about that. I mean, you start with Europe, and then you come to the East Coast of the United States, which is much more flexible and sort of cutting edge. And then you cross the continent to California, and then you're really on the cutting edge. I think it's partly because it's a newer society; it doesn't have all the tradition and so forth that's in others. But One of the most interesting things happening in this country now is not only these state initiatives that you mentioned, and I think the California Solar Initiative is an important one, but there are 180 mayors, including mayors of the largest cities in the country like Los Angeles and New York, who are supporting the Kyoto Protocol, who've signed on to support it. And I find this interesting because it is, in effect, a grassroots political revolution. Mayors around the country of both parties, this is a bipartisan effort, are taking over responsibilities that traditionally have belonged in Washington. In effect, they're filling the vacuum that exists in Washington now on climate policy.
But as you say, if China and India are going to swamp the U.S. in 25 years in terms of leadership, isn't it just as important or more important for these countries to, quote, get the message and move toward more energy efficiency and alternative renewable energy sources?
There's no question about that. We're beginning to see some of that in these countries now. I think the Chinese, with their serious pollution problems, are beginning to realize that one of the best investments they can make is in energy efficiency, for example. They have been surprisingly lax and uninterested in energy efficiency compared with, say, the Japanese, which are a country which is a neighbor. They're beginning to see not only the costs of the energy itself, but the environmental fallout from using so much energy. China is now just beginning to mount a major, potentially massive effort to develop its wind resources. This I find encouraging. India is actually well along with wind. I think it now ranks fourth or fifth in the world in its wind generating capacity. And one of the major international companies in this field is now an Indian company.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have to take a short break and come right back and talk more with Lester Brown, author of Plan B 2.0 or 2.0, whichever you wish, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. He'll be here to talk with us. Also, we're going to change gears a little bit, have Lester Brown stay with us, and also talk a bit about AIDS in China and an HIV infection spreading rapidly around that country. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Take more of your calls after this break. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR stations. And from the National Science Foundation, America's investment in the future. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting two new science screenplays, Hubble and Love is Brilliant, at the 2005 Tribeca Film Festival. And from Affymetrics, molecular technologies for helping scientists understand and improve health. Affymetrics, the way ahead. Affymetrics.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Lightning Rods Printing, International Diplomacy. Ben Franklin turns 300 this month. I'm Ira Flatto. Join me on the next Science Friday for a look at the colonial inventor, socialite, and statesman. Plus a round trip to collect stardust and a one-way ticket to Pluto. That's on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about China's future and the implications for the environment with my guest Lester Brown, president and founder of the Earth Policy Institute. His new book is called Plan B 2.0, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Lester, you make an interesting point in your book about what might happen if we shift from fossil fuels to other grain-based fuels like ethanol. There would be more pressure to use food for fuel. We would let people starve that way.
One of the consequences of rising oil prices that we've always worried about is the effect on food production costs. And that's a legitimate concern, for sure. But what we're also seeing when oil prices get up to $40 a barrel or over $60 a barrel where they are now, is that it suddenly becomes very profitable to convert agricultural commodities into automotive fuel. We see this with ethanol distilleries. We see it with biodiesel refineries. And it's an interesting situation because the world price of oil will become the support price not only for farm commodities, but it will also establish the minimum price for food. Because if at any time the fuel value of a commodity is greater than the food value, it will be converted into fuel. In effect, we're setting the stage for competition between supermarkets and service stations. Until a few years ago, the only important group of buyers in world commodity markets were those who were buying for food processors, who would take the agricultural commodities and convert them into products to go on supermarket shelves. Now we have a second group, and this group is buying for fuel producers. We see them in Europe, particularly with biodiesel, in this country with ethanol. We used 34 million tons of grain last year, enough to feed 100 million people, for producing ethanol. In Brazil, ethanol production is growing very rapidly, by leaps and bounds, in fact, because ethanol produced from sugarcane is actually cheaper than gasoline produced from oil at $60 a barrel. So we're seeing a fuzzing of the line between the food economy and the fuel economy, and dealing with higher food prices, if oil prices stay high, is going to be one of the big political challenges in the years ahead.
We're talking this hour about China's future and the future impact that will have on the rest of the world and implications for the environment with my guest Lester Brown, author of Plan B 2.0, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. By the end of 2004, an estimated 78 million people worldwide were infected with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, and China is not immune to the epidemic. According to 2003 statistics compiled by UNAIDS, as many as 1.5 million Chinese were thought to be infected with HIV. UNAIDS says China has one of the fastest growing HIV epidemics in the world. My next guest has traveled to China, where she is working on trials for an HIV vaccine. She's here in New York to talk about it. Sarah Schlesinger is Research Associate Professor in the Laboratory of Cellular Immunology and Physiology at Rockefeller University and the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center. She's, as I say, here with us in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
How bad is it fair to call it an epidemic in China?
It is definitely fair to call it an epidemic, and it's an epidemic that's still growing and still in the early phases as compared to, say, the epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa, which would be considered a mature epidemic.
Mm-hmm. And does China recognize that and working towards?
Yes. I mean, the good news is that, yes, China does recognize that. And I think that they've begun to mobilize, and the resources of the developed world, both UNAIDS, the Gates Foundation, a number of other organizations, including our own, have been called upon to help in that effort and use the experience garnered in other places in the world to help change the course of the epidemic, because the good news is it's still early enough to do that.
And how is it spreading? Is it in all parts of China?
No, that's actually a very interesting question. There are two major sites of the epidemic, and the place where my colleagues and I work is Yunnan Province, which is the southwestern portion of China that borders Burma. And that epidemic is largely fueled by IV drug use and the proximity to the Golden Triangle. There's also some spread of heterosexual sexual epidemic from Thailand, which is a more mature epidemic. And that epidemic is sort of an organic epidemic, much like that in South Asia, Southeast Asia, and Africa. There's an additional distinct epidemic in farther north in central China, in Henan province, which has been fueled by unsafe blood collection practices. And that's a unique and distinct epidemic that comparisons are odious, and no epidemic is more tragic than any other. But this one's particularly poignant because it's taken place in the sort of agricultural heart of the country, where there are these peasant farmers who are very poor in terms of cash, but they have agricultural riches, they have food. And there were blood collection practices to make plasma that involved not changing the cassettes in the machinery that was used to collect the blood,
and spread HIV that way.
You're
working on a vaccine.
Yes, I am working.
Being tested in China.
We're working. It will be tested in China. It's currently being tested in New York, and we are making all plans and working hard to move toward testing in China. Both here in New York and my colleagues in China are working on manufacturing the vaccine that will be tested in China.
And so you were telling me that you just signed up your last patient.
Oh, right.
We just
signed up our last patient today. So our vaccine is two distinct products, one that's DNA and one that's a modified smallpox vaccine. And we believe you need to use both together to get the kind of immune response we hope for. So we've completed testing on the DNA portion. When I was here last year, we had just begun the trial of the smallpox-like vaccine, and we enrolled our last volunteer this morning.
Why China? Why test it in China?
Well, that's an interesting question. And the reason for testing it in China is probably complicated in several fold. Most simplistically, the epidemic is in a place where one can do efficacy testing. So to know if a vaccine works, because we don't have a model, a good animal model that would give us the answer, nor do we have a test that we can do on people's blood who received the vaccine, you have to go in, do what's called a field trial or a phase three efficacy trial, where you go into a place where there's a high incidence or a high number of people getting infected. And you have to figure out how many people are getting infected. Then you have to bring in all of the things to prevent infection that we already have: education, condoms, clean needles. Then resurvey to make sure still enough people are getting infected to test it. And then ask people to come forward, volunteer in an informed consent manner, you know, respecting human subjects protection, which is very, very important to us and to all of our colleagues. And then you give the vaccine to half the people or two-thirds of the people, and you give a placebo or an irrelevant vaccine to the others, and then you follow and see who gets infected. And if all of your infections fall into the group that got the placebo, you know your vaccine worked. And if they fall equally in the two groups, sadly, it didn't.
Yeah.
And this is called a field trial. So to do that, you have to have a site. But you have to know where you're going to test it before you make the vaccine, because you want to match it to the strain of HIV that circulates in the place in which you're going to test it. So China was a place with the appropriate kind of epidemic, where my boss, David Ho, had both ties and the appropriate kinds of connections to allow the work to go forward. And so that's how the choice was made.
1-800-989-8255. We're talking with Sarah Schlesinger of Rockefeller University and the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center. And Lester Brown, author of Plan B 2.0, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. Lester, do you think the AIDS epidemic impacts the future of China here?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say how exciting it is that we're at the point where, as Sarah was describing, we have a vaccine that has a chance of preventing AIDS. That's a major advance if it materializes in the field trials. The thing that I think about in particular with an AIDS epidemic, and we have much more experience in Africa, is the relationship between disease and hunger. Because as this disease uniquely takes its heavy toll among adults, and particularly younger adults, there are a lot of villages in Africa where there's almost a missing generation now. There are elderly people and there are a lot of youngsters, but not many people in between. And in these villages, it's becoming very difficult to produce enough food to supply needs. So hunger and malnutrition are expanding in Africa in part as a result of the AIDS epidemic there. But the infection rates are very, very high compared with those in Africa, of course.
Right.
In China, of course.
Lester, what you say is absolutely true and tremendously poignant for anybody who's ever been to a village where you see this missing generation. And in the Henan epidemic, the one with the blood selling, that's already happened. And you see grandparents and small children and really nobody in the income-producing generation, because they're all dead.
Do you find a different way that the Chinese are attacking the problem than other epidemics around the world are?
Well, I think that in China, there's a tremendous amount of technology. Yeah. There's a tremendous willingness to embrace technology. And there's a tremendous ability to get people to all work on something, which is, it's kind of mind-boggling, you know, coming from having come from New York. And there's infrastructure there that really doesn't exist in other places in the developing world. I mean, you have this odd juxtaposition of high tech and really developing world. So, for instance, the vaccine on which I work, and I'd like to just make clear that both of these vaccines have been sold to the People's Republic of China for $1 by my boss. And so they are Chinese vaccines, and they've been embraced and taken on that way, which is wonderful on several levels.
So they're making it themselves.
They're making it themselves. They have to, right, in order for it to be tested there. So the Institute of Medical Biology, which is where our vaccines are being made, makes more polio vaccine than any organization in the United States. I mean, they make the polio vaccine for China. So they know how to make vaccines. They have GMP manufacturing practices in place. They have the equipment. They have the personnel.
They have wealth. They have wealth there as opposed to other poorer countries.
Exactly.
That can't
so they
do
have
this.
They have technology.
Yeah.
They have wealth. And they have personnel who have both technological understanding and the ability to learn this stuff very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so that's a huge resource and a huge boon and a fundamental difference from, say, sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah. Talking about AIDS and China this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Sarah Schlesinger at Rockefeller University and the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center, Lester Brown, president of the Earth Policy Institute. Lester, things sound, you know, a little bit more hopeful than they do in other parts of the world.
In terms of AIDS in China,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, the Chinese government has been slow to respond to the AIDS epidemic, but it looks as though it's beginning to take it seriously now and to move ahead, and that's encouraging. Obviously, with a population of 1.3 billion, anything that can be done to keep infection levels low is a major contribution.
Mm-hmm. I have just about a minute. I want to ask each of you to sum up, if you can. Lester, let me ask you to go first. Do you think that, you know, we can head off this global tragedy that you see coming before we get to a tipping point?
A lot depends on what we do in the next few years. Time is probably our scarcest resource. I didn't talk much about what we could do in this country with automobiles, gas electric hybrids, mm-hmm, with batteries and so forth. But if we use wind energy, if we were to invest at the same time we're investing in gas electric hybrids with a plug-in capacity and build hundreds or maybe even thousands of wind farms across the country, we can essentially run our cars on wind energy and at a cost of something like the equivalent of 60 cent a gallon gasoline. The neat thing about this model for the transportation sector is that it provides cheap energy and it is inexhaustible. It's also within our boundaries. So when you referred to Plan B 2.0 earlier as being sort of a grim report, but most of the book deals with solutions, and there are some very exciting ones there, including shifting to gas electric hybrids and using wind power as a source of electricity.
Is this going to come from the grassroots up, or is the government ever going to take a hand
right
from
now,
the
it's,
top down?
Right now it's coming from the grassroots up, but it could also be corporate leaders. I mean, I've talked and corresponded with Mr. Toyota, the senior member of the family at Toyota in near Nagoya in Japan, and tried to encourage him to get a plug-in model on the market, because I think the interest in wind energy and the enormous potential we have could marry with that technology to create an exciting new automotive energy economy where we can largely run our cars on wind energy.
Do you talk to Toyota because you think Detroit just is not listening?
Well, Toyota's way ahead in the thinking in this area, and unfortunately, Detroit is years behind in developing this technology.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Schlesinger, where does your vaccine go from here? What kind of timetable are we talking about?
Well, I agree with Lester completely. I mean, time is our most precious resource with this epidemic, and we're acutely aware of that, though. to develop a vaccine also takes time, and we've been very fortunate in our ability to move as expeditiously as possible. Our colleagues in China have manufactured pilot lots, which are getting qualified. And we're finishing the phase one trials here. There's one more to conduct, the combination trial, and we're hoping to start that in this year. And that will be done within a year, we hope, as well. So within 2 to 3 years, we're certainly hoping to be in more advanced development in Yunnan. And that's the only thing that we can do is put one foot in front of each other, do the work as expeditiously as we can, and hope. You know, ultimately, we're going to have to be lucky. You know, the biggest question of all, of course, is will these vaccines work? And will they work? You know, they might not work to prevent the epidemic the way we might hope completely, but they might work well enough to make a significant impact. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're all hoping for.
Well, good luck to you. Thank you very much for joining us. Sarah Schlesinger is a research associate professor in the Laboratory of Cellular Immunology and Physiology at Rockefeller University and the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center. Lester Brown is founder and president of the Earth Policy Institute. His new book, Plan B 2.0, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. A terrific read. I recommend all of you to pick up a copy. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ara.
You're welcome. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Our directors are Charles Berquist in New York and Sarah Handel in Washington. Charles is also our web producer, and our intern is Flora Lichtman. You can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find all the links we talked about today in case you missed any of them. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. Free curricula that we make for schools who have trouble teaching science. You want some help teaching science? And, you know, your grade school, go over there, click on the four teachers. We have a curricula that we have put together for Science Friday. Also, back editions of Science Friday you could download and listen on your PC, take them with you on your iPod. We podcast Science Friday on that website. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.